Good morning. This is Stephen Medford. I'm your host this morning for the Monday edition of Mornings for the Master. And we are kind of taking a break from what we've been doing. And last time we looked at Song of Solomon, we looked at the very beginning of Song of Solomon, and we did like an introduction and got down to verse 6. And so today we're going to pick up at verse 7. We have this couple that is getting interested in one another, and we looked at why the character of the man was wonderful, and therefore the virgins loved him. And we see a little bit what she thinks about him. She is lovesick. We can go ahead and read some of what we talked about last time and go into what we're going to talk about this time as well. So Song of Solomon, it starts out saying, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine, because of the fragrance of your good ointments. Your name is ointment poured forth, therefore the virgins love you. Draw me away, we will run after you. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keepers of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. Tell me, O you whom I love, where do you feed your flock? Where do you make it rest at noon? For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? If you do not know, O fairest among women, follow the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, and your neck with chains of gold. We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. While the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes. Behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Also, our bed is green, and the beams of our houses are cedar, and our rafters of fir. I am a rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." Maybe we'll get that far today. This is a great book, a wonderful book, and it teaches us some about romantic love. And we've looked at what should draw a person. We've looked at how they're not going to compromise their morality. They were very much drawn to each other because of the name that they had, the character that they had, and it's going to grow into the beauty of each other. We're going to see that here. She was a hard worker, even though she was displeased some with her looks. We've seen that. Everyone rejoices in this relationship, and we talk some about that. So now, starting in verse 7, she tells him, "Tell me, O you whom I love, where do you feed your flocks? Where do you make it rest at noon? For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? And so obviously here, she wants to be with him. They desire time together. She desires time to be with him. And it is sad when couples do not want to be together. Sadly, I know men who don't really want to go home after work. We should desire to be together. There are couples that like being together, but then they also want time away. And I suppose that's okay. But to me, it's a little concerning that they need a break from one another. When that happens, it seems like there's something that's just not right. I'm reminded of Genesis chapter 2, where it ends that they were naked and unashamed. They had nothing to hide from each other. When we need a break from one another, to me, that should be alarming, at least. We want to be together at the beginning of the relationship, and if anything changes where we don't want to be together, then whatever changes take place need to be reconciled. We need to desire to be together, and the fact that we don't should be concerning. We should always treat the other person that they desire to be with us. And that's what we see in this book. They always speak kindly to one another. There's a scene in which I guess there's a little hardship in the book that they separate from one another for a little while. But we should desire to be together. And notice how they talk to one another as we go through this lesson. They always talk in such a way where it's obvious they're trying to lift up one another, and they don't give either one a reason for the other not to want to be with them. So she wants to be with him, and notice she says, "Where do you make it lie down at noon?" This is broad daylight. They are not married yet. Before couples marry, they should never place themselves in places where they can be easily tempted. Romans chapter 13, verse 14, make no provisions for the flesh. 2 Timothy 2, verse 22, flee from youthful lust. Don't put yourselves in situations where you can be tempted. So, where do you make it rest at noon? I mentioned last time that this is a relationship between a man and a woman. But God designed marriage to show the type of relationship that he desires with his church. And so from this, I think we can learn we should desire to be with God. We should seek to be where God is. Seek the Lord. And I wrote down a couple of verses here in 1 Chronicles chapter 28 and verse 9. Solomon is taking the throne and his father David is talking to him. And he says, "You, Solomon, my son, know the God of your father and serve him with a perfect heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches the hearts and understands the imaginations of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found by you. And if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever." In 2 Chronicles 15 and verse 2, it says that he went out to meet Asa and said to him, "Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him. But if you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you." Isaiah 55 verse 6, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near." Acts 17 and verse 26, "And he has made of all nations of men of one blood to dwell on all the face of the earth, ordaining four appointed seasons and boundaries for their dwelling, to seek the Lord, if perhaps they might feel after him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us." And so just like this woman desires to be with this man, the church, God desires that the church desire to be with him. And that's the way he intends it. That's the way he wants it. She says, "Why should I be like one who veils herself?" Normally, people associate this with prostitution. In Genesis chapter 38 and verse 14, we have an example of Tamar veiling herself so that she appears to be a prostitute to Judah. We also have an example in 2 Samuel 15 and verse 30, where David is running from Absalom and he is mourning. He's shamed, and so he covers his face. And so we have examples here of people covering their face, but it's always shameful, if not evil. And so this woman says, why should I be like one who veils herself, either trying to find a Solomon, going through risky places, or saying that Solomon, she wants to know where Solomon is going to be so that she doesn't have to go to a place where she might be ashamed, that she might have to hide something. And so what this is saying here, I believe, is she will not compromise her morality. She wants to do things openly, and she doesn't want to be ashamed about anything. She wants to be with a man that's going to keep her an upright, moral person. She's not going to go in places where she has to hide or where she's going to be ashamed of being there. She will not compromise her purity for anyone, no matter how much she might think she loves him. No matter how good other people think his name is, she's not going to compromise. Of course, 1 Corinthians 15:33 is a verse we use often. Do not be deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. And so he answers back in verse 8. If you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. So he's saying here, don't take my word for it. If you don't know, look yourself. He is unashamed. He has nothing to hide. The relationship is open. They're not hiding anything. If you are desiring to keep secrets or some time away so that you can relax from your spouse, this is not a good thing. They're open in everything. She has just expressed a little doubt and fear concerning her appearance, but he addresses her as the fairest among women to remove all doubt and fear that he loves her and appreciates her and thinks that she is beautiful. The relationship we have should remove all doubt and fear concerning the weaknesses that are in ourselves or the weaknesses that our mate may see in themselves. We overlook those weaknesses. We believe that they are perfect for us, or at least we love them in spite of their weaknesses. They don't have to be ashamed or fear. Notice he does not say, don't bother me at work. If I'm feeding the flocks, you need to stay away. She is a priority in his life. Both should make the other feel like they are priorities in their lives. This is true in every relationship. When you think about general relationships, Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3 says that we should esteem one another as better than ourselves. Ephesians 5 verse 21, we need to submit to one another. And we see this even more so in marriage. 1 Corinthians 7 verse 4, we are to give ourselves to the other. They have possession of us. In Acts chapter 20 and verse 35, you have the words of Jesus, it's more blessed to give than to receive. And so I think that's a good idea here in relationships. When we give ourselves to one another, when we do things for one another, all relationships are like that. But how much more marriage? He doesn't say, don't bother me at work. She is a priority. Even when I'm at work, you come first. I'm going to make sure of that. And then he says, feed your little goats among the flocks. You know, stay with the shepherds. There is nothing to fear with me. This shows his kindness, his tenderness, his gentleness. It's also seen in the fact that he calls her the fairest among women. This shows us, I think, that Jesus is extremely kind, tender, and gentle with us. He's not hiding anything from us. He desires us to be with him. I think about Matthew 12 and verse 20, which says, "He will not break a bruised reed. He will not quench a smoldering wick until he sends out judgment to victory." In Luke 12:32, it says, "Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Do not fear, little flock, tender, I'm going to take care of you. A bruised reed, he's not going to break. Even though something is extremely fragile, he's going to be very delicate. That's the way God is with us. We should desire to be with him because of that. Going on to the next verse. Verse 9. He says, "I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots." When I got down to here, I was looking at the word love, and I realized that there are three different words used for love in this book and in this first chapter. The first one is a sexual desire, a sensual desire, and it's used in verse 2, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." That is a sensual desire. Your love is better than wine. And it's used in such places as well, in other places in the Bible. We talked about this word. It's kind of weird because it can be translated uncle. The next word that's used in verse 3, "Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment pour forth. Therefore, the virgins love you." That's a different word, and that is affection. And it is used, for instance, of Abraham and Isaac. "Take your son, your only son, whom you love. You are extremely affectionate for." So these people are affectionate toward Solomon. Rightly do they love you. And here, in verse 9, we have another word for love that really means a companion or an equal, another of the same. The only other time this word is used is in Judges 11 and verse 37, where Jephthah has vowed to sacrifice his daughter, and the daughter says, "Let me take my companions, my friends, my loved ones, and go and mourn my virginity." That's Judges 11, verse 37. That's the only time this word is used, but the male form is used in a number of other circumstances. Genesis 38 and verse 12, Judah's friend that he sends to go pay the harlot. In Genesis 43 and verse 33, Joseph and his brothers, his companions, his ones that he loves in this circumstance. It's used of just other people that are equals in general, though, not necessarily loved ones. In Exodus 2 and verse 13, Moses finds two of his brethren fighting, and he says, "Why do you hit your companion?" And so we see things like this. So a couple of things on this word. First of all, I think it's significant because this word shows that Solomon does not see her as some type of sexual object, not a toy, not a lesser, not a servant. He may want her, but his views toward her are that of an equal and that of a friend that he can trust. The best friend of any married person should be their spouse. Neither one should look down on the other. They are equals. Make time for each other to cultivate this relationship. So he says, "I have compared you, my love, to a filly among Pharaoh's chariots." Now notice, again, as we go through this, they are complimenting one another, pouring out compliments, and lifting one another up. "I have compared you, my love, to a filly among Pharaoh's chariots." Their words are always gentle, tender, and kind. Notice they show by how they speak to one another that they are concerned about what the other person thinks. They want them to know that we believe they are wonderful, beautiful, great. I truly believe if you fail to show tenderness to your spouse, they are going to look for it in other places. And we don't want them doing that. Show them how much you love them. Tell them how much you love them. Okay, so now let's get to this idea of a filly among Pharaoh's chariots. The word filly simply means a female horse. It's not necessarily a filly, a young or old. It's just a female horse. And so a lot of translations say, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. Now, Solomon had a thing for horses. In places like 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 26, chapter 10 and verse 26 and 28, we see how much he gathered horses. He liked horses, and especially from Egypt. 2 Chronicles 1:16 is another verse that shows he gathered these horses, got them from Egypt. And so when he talks about her being a filly among Pharaoh's chariots, a lot of people believe that this is a precious and prized possession in Pharaoh's stock. But there are many people that believe, and they'll say that Pharaoh's chariots were only pulled by stallions. And there is an account of a mare being released among the chariots of Pharaoh during a war. And I'm told that the war could not resume until that mare was killed. It caused such a frenzy, this mare in heat. And so a lot of people believe that this verse is saying, pretty much, you drive me wild. You are like a mare among a bunch of stallions. We are all fighting over you. We all want to be with you. And so that's what this is saying. You drive me crazy. You drive all the guys crazy. And we should find creative ways, I suppose, to compliment our spouse. But we should desire them like this. There's something wrong if you don't. As I say that, I know a lot of relationships don't have this. This is the ideal. This is something we need to be pressing forward to. This is the perfect. So going on, he says, your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. So notice he compliments parts of her body that are open to him. He's going to compliment her eyes in verse 15. He does not move down her body. This is saved for later. They are not married yet. In Job 31 and verse 1, Job talks about how he made a covenant with his eyes. Therefore, how can he look upon a virgin? We need to be the same type of way. I also think it's significant that he does not say that the ornaments in the chains are beautiful, but that the parts of her body are beautiful, and they just draw attention to these parts of her body, or they complement the parts of her body well. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. It seems important to me that we don't always compliment in generalities, but he compliments specific parts of her. Couples should tell each other the specific things that they are pleased with and enjoy, whether it be physical attributes or something that they do. This will help both involved to remain happy in their love and encourage each of them to care for themselves, to make themselves more presentable, to keep themselves healthy and fit. If we compliment their physical appearances and tell them the things that we like them doing, this will make them good stewards of the bodies and as well as doing things that keep the other happy. It'll make them want to do these things more and do more actions for the other person. So he compliments her specifically. And then the New King James says that the daughters of Jerusalem say, we will make you ornaments with gold, ornaments of gold with studs of silver. The you here is feminine singular, so it's talking to the woman, but we're unsure who the we is. And a lot of people think that this is Solomon talking. We, meaning he and the woman, will make for her ornaments of gold with studs of silver. We seems most naturally to be that in my mind. It's almost like he's saying to the Shulamite, Let's go shopping. Let's develop these things for you. We want to do things for you to make you feel important, to make you feel more beautiful. It may be understood that they're going to build on who she is and make her a better person, even though this is somewhat imagery, to look even better than she is, even more presentable to society. And I think this is a good point, and we see this later on in the book as well, that our relationships should be edifying and make us better people. And so we turn now to the Shulamite in verse 12. She says, while the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. I suppose there's probably more here than I see. But in my mind, she knows her power over him. At least the power to attract him. The influence that she has toward him. I think about Proverbs chapter 30, verses 18 and 19. When the Bible talks about, many times in the Old Testament, we read something like, there are three things, and then there are four things. There are six things that the Lord hates, yea, seven are an abomination to him. And to me, that's an idea of this is not a complete list. And so here in Proverbs 30, verses 18 and 19, it says, three things are too wonderful for me, yes, four which I do not know. So here are some things that he has thought about, and he can't figure out how it works, what's going on here. The first thing he says is the way of an eagle in the air. Thought about it, can't figure out how that eagle can fly and do what it does. Second thing, the way of a snake on a rock. It has no legs to move around. It seems like if its belly moved, it would just move back and forth. But yet it moves quickly on a rock. The way of a snake on a rock. And then he says the way of the ship in the middle of the sea. Can't figure out how they know where they are or how they work, how they can use the same wind to go different directions. But the last thing that he mentions here is the way of a man with a maid. To me, that's the climax. I can't understand why people act the way they do when they're trying to get a girl. And so she says, the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. She knows she has some type of influence over him. She knows she's turning his head. She is doing things that please him. This is often done before marriage, but if you don't want to lose the romance in your marriage, you have to keep it up. Women will always have power over men, and they can always do things to please the man. And when I say power over men, I'm not saying that he doesn't have any control or anything like that. Like she can control him like a puppet. But she has power, great power to influence him. And you can go throughout history and see how Solomon's wives turned them away, turned him away. Adam and Eve, she turns him away. All throughout history, we have women provoking men. I think about Numbers 22 through 25, where you have Balak and Balaam, and what happened there with the Moabites and the whoever it was. So you have power of women, and so she knows that. And then she says, verse 13, a bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts. You can understand this some different ways, I suppose. Of course, this would be something that she delights in. Not only her, but it was very costly. It could be sensual. In Proverbs 7, verse 17, myrrh is used of a woman trying to entice a man. He is precious to her. This is one of the gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh that Jesus receives. It's costly. And so this is something that is precious to her. It says, that lies all night between my breasts. The word lie means to stay permanently or tarry or to lodge there. This is the permanent place for him. He is always close to me, near my heart. The desire for him, his memory is sweet to me in fragrance, and I want him here. She may be saying that she wants Solomon to spend the night right there between her breasts. We already saw her saying, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. He's not only precious to him, to her, but I think it's significant that this bread of myrrh, people, this bundle of myrrh, people say it was made of wax. And it was bundled up in cloth, cloth dipped in wax. And when it was against her breast, her body heat would heat it up a little and the wax would melt. And it would make her smell sweet, even when she took it off. And I kind of think that's, again, shows how we should help one another. He made her smell sweet. He made her more presentable. He made her a better person. How often we see both boys and girls start dating someone who causes them to compromise their character, maybe lie to their parents or do things that they shouldn't do, make them desire to do things that are wrong. In this relationship, they make each other better. They make each other more desirable to those around them. I think about the song, a country song, "You Look So Good in Love." When people are in love, they are prettier inside and out. Going on to verse 14, she says, My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of Engedi. And I think this is neat. Engedi was an oasis in the middle of the desert. It contained waterfalls and streams and lush vegetation and various birds and animals. It was like a paradise in the middle of the desert. And the henna blooms were white flowers with very dark berries that give off a sweet-smelling fragrance. And what I read said it lingered in the atmosphere. So the idea is, in this desert, you are a sweet-smelling, refreshing spot. All other men are like desert, but you are a place where I can go to relax. I can be pleased. It's a lovely place. So the wife and the husband always need to live in such a way that the other is willing to come home to them, that they will be a place of peace and rest and refreshing in this harsh world in which we live. Sometimes we have no idea what the other has gone through throughout the day, but we always want them to be at peace with us, to be refreshed with us. It is the duty of you as a spouse, as a mate, to make your other want to come to you and to refresh them. Make it easy for your spouse to look at you like this. And again, as I think of the relationship between the church and God, God has never done anything to hurt us or to harm us. Whenever we are punished by Him, it is always with our best interest in mind to bring them out, to bring us back. God has never hurt us for the sake of hurting us. In James chapter 1 and verse 5, He gives to all men generously and without reproach. Verse 13, He is not temptable and doesn't cause anyone to commit sin. In verse 17, He is the giver of every good and perfect gift. He is the Father of lights with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. He always desires us to be with us, to want us to do good, to want to bless us. He is eager to accept us no matter what we have done. He always wants us back. Isaiah chapter 1 verse 18, He says, "Come now, let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they be crimson, they shall be as wool." In fact, a lot of times we quote Isaiah 55 and we talk about how God's ways are not our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. But if we look at the verses just before that, He is saying, if you come back to me, I will forgive you. Man may be unwilling to forgive you. Man may always hold a grudge. but my ways are not like man's ways. In Hosea chapter 3, we have a beautiful picture of this, where Hosea is told to go and buy back his wife that has lived a life of harlotry, run around. Men would not do that. Men would say, you know, be fed up with her and leave her. But no, Hosea goes and takes care of her. And this is the picture of God. God always wants to be with us. We can always find refreshing with God, no matter what we've done. This is the way God is. And I think this is the point of the book of Ecclesiastes. No real pleasure can be found in anything else on earth but in God. The earth is a desert, and God is the henna blossoms in the valley of En-Gedi. Our spouse should be that for us. The place we find refreshing, the place we find help, the place we can go for peace and comfort. Verse 15. The beloved, says Solomon, behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes. So again, before we talked about how she was dark, he says, no, you are fair. Repeats it twice. Listen to me. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes. Doves are used throughout this book, the symbol of a dove. And I think that's interesting, and I really want to know why. Of course, doves have always been a symbol of love. They've always been a symbol of peace. They seem to be a more delicate bird. When you read Genesis chapter 8, when he lets the raven out of the ark, it flies back and forth. But the dove can't do that. The dove has to come back. They are beautiful birds. Psalm 68 and verse 13 talks about their silver wings. They seem to be somewhat defenseless. I don't know if Psalm 74 verse 19 kind of alludes to that. But if you look at pictures of doves, here it says she has dove's eyes. Dove's eyes are very dark and contrasted with they're lighter gray. They're very beautiful. And this might just be talking about how her eyes are just beautiful. But it could be something more. Doves are one of the few animals that mate for life. And that might be why they're used for a love symbol. Of course, the way they communicate to one another. The way they are lovey-dovey. The way they coo at each other. People mention that. That might be why they're a symbol for love. The way they act. So, he says you have dove's eyes. And throughout, like I said, he compares her to a dove. And she turns around and uses the same compliment in the male form. He says you are fair. You are beautiful. She says, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Handsome, like I said, is the masculine form of the feminine plural above. And I think this is a good way of showing love should be reciprocated. If someone does something nice for you, you should say thank you. I'm reminded of Romans chapter 1, verse 18 and following, where it starts out talking about how the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness of man, because they suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And it goes on and talks about their sin. And it says, although they knew God, they did not honor him as God, nor were they thankful. God created them. God gave them everything to sustain their life. And really, you look around, to make life beautiful, and yet they did not honor him as God or give thanks. The natural thing to do is to say thank you. If someone does something kind for you, if someone does something great for you, you should want to please them as well. And that's exactly what we have going on here. You are handsome. You are pleasant. The word pleasant can also be translated delightful. They act in such a way that they are a delight to each other. We need to be like that. It's so easy for us to get in ruts where we seem to be just mean to each other. A lot of times people are nicer to absolute strangers than they are to their family. This should not be the case. Maybe you've had a hard day at work, but you come home and you take it out on your family. No, we should be kind and sweet. And you can't wait for the other to be kind and sweet. You should be that way yourself, just like God is to us. While we were sinners, while we were ungodly, I'm reminded of Romans chapter 5, verses 6 and following. God loved us in this state, and we return that love. Someone's got to step forward. If you're constantly waiting for the other person to apologize, your relationship's only going to go downhill. You need to be the one to step up and change, to show your spouse the affection, the respect that they maybe not deserve, but that they desire. And so she returns the compliment. They are pleasant to one another. And she goes on to say, also, our bed is green. In verse 17, the beams of our houses are cedar and our rafters fir. Now, some take this to be a house that Solomon has built for her. And it might be. Solomon is doing something for her. But there are others who understand it, and I think this is more natural way of understanding it. Our bed is green, the green grass, it's flourishing. And I think it's interesting that the houses here is plural. The beams of our houses are cedars and our rafters fir. They have trees over them. So I kind of think they're out in the open. Again, they're not doing anything in private. They're not putting themselves in situations where they can be tempted before marriage. The fact that the word houses is plural kind of shows this as well. And now we go on into chapter 2. She says, I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Now, a lot of times in songs, these are used to talk about the greatness of Christ. Here it is the woman saying this. And these flowers are not spectacular flowers. They're not expensive. But they are flowers. And so she says, I think, something here like, I feel special and delicate like other women. She has lifted herself up, where before she was saying, don't look upon me because I'm dark. Now she feels like a flower. I think of certain songs that refer to the woman as the buttercup. That's used, it's a common flower. It's not something that we think of as special like a rose, but it's still sweet. And so she sees herself something as sweet now. Her view of herself has blossomed. Before, she didn't want people to look at her, but now she is worthy of attention. His love and recognition toward her has caused her to think better of herself, has increased her self-esteem. And again, like I said, we're going to talk about this. The relationship edifies and builds each other up. And so she says, I'm a rose of Sharon. I'm a lily among the valleys. He turns around and says, verse 2, like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. She believes that she is special, but nothing great. He comes back with, compared to everyone else, you're the only flower out there. Everyone else is a thorn or a thorn bush. Everyone else is distasteful to him when it comes to love. This means that men should not notice any woman besides their spouse. And it should be the same way for the spouse. Too many are the idea of we can look but don't touch. Or just because I'm on a diet doesn't mean I can't look at the menu. We don't want to look at other women. Other women are thorns. We have our flower. And again, it is the job of you to make your partner desire you. Treat him nice. Treat her nice. make her want to be with you. Don't make her go look at other people. Don't make her desire to be among the thorns because you're more thorny. Notice that they compete with one another, seemingly, to see who can outdo each other in compliments. You are a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. You are you're handsome. I don't know, a bundle of myrrh that lies all night between my breasts. You are a lily among thorns or a flower among thorns. You're the greatest. Everyone else is nothing compared to you. And again, Acts 20:35, it's more blessed to give than to receive. Philippians 2:3, esteem one another is more important than yourselves. This should be done in all relationships, but how much more marriage? Live in such a way that your spouse will desire you. Compliment them. Make it easy for them to come home. Make them want to come home, desire to come home. And unless you've married a creep, if you live like this, they will return that love. Sometimes people have been so rough that when they change and start living sweetly toward their spouse, it takes their spouse a long time to respond. But they will if you have married any type of a decent person. One thing I want to say here is that God doesn't want to be the priority in our life. He wants to be the only thing in our life. Everyone else is a thorn. We love our spouse because we love God and want to please God. We do good for others because we love God and want to please God. And so he turns around and says, like a lily among thorns, she again comes back with another compliment for him. Like, again, they're outdoing one another in compliments. She says, verse 3 of chapter 2, like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. Now, this is really unimportant, but I mention it because if you're reading other places, you might come across this. Some commentators say that this tree is not what we think of as an apple tree, but it might be a pomegranate or an orange tree or an apricot tree or something, I don't know. But it's some type of sweet fruit tree. And some believe that this is the actual start of looking at lovemaking. Again, I don't see that here, but you might come across that. They're cultivating sexual desires. But an apple tree is usually cultivated in an orchard. An apple tree is nearly, at least it's uncommon among the nearly useless trees of the forest and the woods. And so she is returning his compliment. She sits down in his shade. I think shade is the idea of protection. Fruit would be the idea of provision. The man protects and provides, but not only so, he does this in such a way that she feels it is much more than just the bare minimum, for sure. But this is something that she delights in. She delights in him. She thinks he is sweet. I don't think the quantity means as much as his effort. The idea I'm trying to think of there is that sometimes, you know, we can't provide a lot of money. We can't have a giant house or something, but it's how he makes her feel when she is in his presence. He protects her. I think about things like, don't allow others to belittle her in your presence. You stand up for her. And of course, you don't belittle her yourself. You don't ever allow your children to disrespect her. You show her that she is number one in the things that you say and the things that you won't put up with from others. Put her life above your own. Other people may get mad at her. Other people may yell at her in a threatening way, but you never will. She will always feel protected with you and never doubt your love. She may have a bad day at work. Her boss may be upset with her, but when she comes home, the man is her paradise in the desert. Everyone looks for security and significance, and if they don't find it with you, they will look for it somewhere else. You provide shade. You provide fruit for your spouse. This is addressed to the man, but in the same sense, the man should feel secure with the woman. If you're giving ideas of maybe leaving or something, the spouse is not going to feel secure. So notice, they both feel that the other is the only one in the world for them. He's the apple tree among the trees of the woods, and she's the lily among the thorns. A spouse must feel this way about their partner, whether it comes natural or not. We need to make sure we cultivate this in our own selves, and also being the person our spouse wants us to be, so it's easy for them to cultivate it in their own minds. We can't entertain meaningful relationships with other people of the opposite sex. Far too many innocent relationships end up in places that they never dreamed they would end up at the beginning of the relationship. Don't talk bad to your spouse. You be the sweet person. Make them feel this way. Going on to verse 4. He brought me to the banqueting house, or the house of wine, and his banner over me was love. Again, there are some who see this as lovemaking and just intoxicating. I kind of think this is just they're going out to a public celebration. He is not ashamed of her. He does not try to hide the relationship at all. Even when they are out, he treats her great. They're at a public celebration, not ashamed or embarrassed. They listen to one another. They're looking intently into one another's eyes. He wants to show her off. His banner over her was love. There's two things I think of in the idea of a banner. First of all, there is the idea of ownership. She belongs to him. When we read about a banner, it's usually in an army. This is who they are. This is who they belong to. This is who they fight for. So he owns her. Women submit to their men. But the other thing is a banner is everyone can see it. And what's this banner that everyone sees? It's his love for her. It is obvious to everyone in the room that this man loves this woman. Maybe they're holding hands. He pulls the chair out for her. He is constantly looking at her in a longing way, paying attention to the things that she says and so forth. How they speak to one another. He acknowledges her. He attends to her wants and wishes. His love for her makes it easy for her to submit to him. And so his banner over her is love. I think it's significant that he praises her privately. We see the compliments that they have, and then he praises her openly in this banquet hall. It's obvious she is number one. And then she says, "Sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick." Refresh me with apples may go back to the fact that he's the apple tree. He wants, or she wants, his fruit, his actions, the things that he does for her. Many people say that raisin cakes were used as an aphrodisiac to excite lovemaking. But I don't know that that's the case. In Hosea chapter 3 and verse 1, it mentions that Israel was going after the raisin cakes of other gods, and they loved to go after them. And so some people see that in this. Of course, false gods often were associated with prostitution and so forth. But it could be that she says, "I'm lovesick. I'm feeling weak. I need to eat. I need some sugar." And so instead of chocolates and candies that we have today, this is what they had: apples and raisin cakes. And so this could be what's going on here. She is really feeling great, lovesick, because of his actions toward her. And then it says, "His left hand is under my head, his right hand embraces me." There are many translations that make this the desire of the woman, that say something like, "Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me," or that his left hand, and so forth. The New American Standard Bible does this. The Amplified Version does this. The Christian Standard Bible, the Contemporary English Bible, the International Standard Version, and the Jewish Publication does all. They all make this a desire, and so it seems to go along more with my thinking that this is more of a desire. This is what she wants. And the last verse that I want to mention here is a very important verse, verse 7, which actually occurs a couple of other times in this book. But it says, I charge or adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. To me, it's interesting to just think about who says this. There are some people that say it goes along with who was speaking before. The woman is saying this. She turns to the daughters of Jerusalem and says, y'all don't need to provoke sexual desire before it's time that you can take it all the way. And of course, women can do this. It is addressed to the daughters of Jerusalem. By the clothes that you wear, by the actions that you do, make sure you do your best not to provoke these things. There's a time and place for it, and it's going to be wonderful, but don't do it beforehand. But who's saying this? Is it the woman? Or a lot of people, I say a lot of people, there are major commentaries that say this is the man. Solomon says, you know, you may want this relationship. You may want my hand under your head and my right hand to embrace you. But we're not going to go further. I adjure you, everyone, you don't stimulate sexual desire before it is time. I kind of think maybe it's the idea of God. I think maybe, and as I read through this book, sometimes God steps in and says something. Maybe that's the case. And if I understand the word charge, the word that's translated charge or adjure, to me, it seems like the idea is swear to me. Don't do this. Swear this to me. And it's interesting that he says by the gazelles or by the does of the field. You can imagine approaching a gazelle or a doe in the wild. I think everyone likes looking at these creatures. When you pass by them on the road, everyone says, look, a deer. They're beautiful creatures. I can't think of anyone who doesn't like looking at them. But when you approach them, are you not extremely thoughtful and slow and gentle? Because what happens? There's going to come a time when you get so close that you frighten them away. Well, sensual love is wonderful. It's a beautiful thing. It's not something to be trifled with or played with. God has designed it because he wants us to enjoy it to the greatest extent possible. But he also put rules on it for us, for our protection. If you want someone to love you in the best way, follow his rules. Don't spook it off. Don't do it too soon. Don't make things difficult. Don't do anything that will cause sexual arousal before marriage. The passion is great and wonderful, designed by God. But if you feed it too soon, it will bring hardship and heartaches. And you can think of ways you can feed that too soon. This passage is here, this verse is here to protect us and to help us have the greatest relationship with our spouse as possible. And that's obviously all we have time for today. I really enjoy this study, and I hope you're enjoying it too. I hope you have been blessed by our time together. If you would like to contact us for any reason, I always want to leave you with that option. You can email us or you can call us. You can email us at mornings@tgrn.org, or you can email me, Stephen, Steven, @tgrn.org, or you can call us 1-844-367-8476. If we can assist you in any way, we would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening.